President Trump tested positive. So have several other world leaders. When British Prime Minister Boris Johnson got COVID-19, he took it way more seriously and told people,
you should lock down parts of the country where there is a high spike in the COVID rate. That's made him very unpopular with a lot of his own backbenchers.
Also today, Filipino-Americans turn out for Trump. Big Oil feels the heat from the sun and wind. And a reporter recalls badgering his editor 30 years ago to send him to Berlin.
I went back 5-6 times. Then he was upset and said, go, go, out.
The press conference that helped bring down the Berlin Wall. I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
El presidente Donald Trump ha dado positivo a su prueba de COVID-19.
Стало известно, что Дональд Трамп и его супруга Мелания заразились коронавирусом. Это
безусловно. أعلن الرئيس الأمريكي دونالد ترامب أنه وزوجته ميلانيا.
In Spanish, Russian, Arabic, and Japanese, the whole world is talking about the president of the United States contracting COVID-19. The global implications of this news are huge, and we'll get to some of that in today's program. Let's remember that President Trump is not the first world leader to test positive for the coronavirus. So have the presidents of Guatemala, Bolivia, Belarus, and Honduras. Back in March, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson also tested positive.
On the advice of the chief medical officer, I've taken a test that has come out positive. So I am working from home, I'm self-isolating, and that's entirely the right thing to do.
In July, Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, also got sick. Bolsonaro told reporters that he felt absolutely fine. He even took off his mask so that reporters could see his face. Trump, Johnson, and Bolsonaro all share something in common. They downplayed the severity of the virus. Johnson changed his tune after spending a week in the hospital, including in the ICU. Bolsonaro, though, did not change his thinking. He continued greeting people, shaking hands, and gathering in crowds. How the coronavirus impacts President Trump and changes his attitude or not, that we'll have to wait and see. Since Johnson fell ill and was hospitalized earlier this year, doctors have learned a lot more about the disease. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show. Could that be good news for President Trump, Alana?
Marco, as you're saying, doctors have learned a lot, and that could be good news. First of all, they've learned a lot about COVID itself. It's not a simple respiratory disease. It can cause problems in the brain and blood. It can affect different organs in the body, and it can lead to long-term lung, kidney, heart complications. And so scientists are still trying to figure out why some people get sick, others don't. But they have a better sense of who's most at risk. And so that's people who are older, who have certain kinds of health issues already, like cancer, heart problems, type 2 diabetes, obesity, and health inequities. They also play a role.
Right. What about treatment? Has that changed? Has it evolved?
It really has. So around the globe, researchers have set up trials to understand from the get-go what drugs and treatments may help. There's been a lot of coordination, and they want to figure out like what helps prevent the virus from replicating or from what prevents the body from overreacting, from inflammation. And that can take a whole long time to figure out. But in places like the US, the UK, and others, they are approving certain drugs for emergency use that have seen positive early signs for treating patients.
So what can someone who's got COVID-19 get now for treatment?
Okay, so one of the big drugs is dexamethasone. It's a steroid. Went through this really big trial in the UK called the Recovery Trial. Scientists found that for really sick patients, especially those on ventilators, it reduced mortality by about a third. There's also remdesivir. This one focuses on reducing how the virus replicates in the body. And a big NIH study in the US found that it was sped up recovery time for some really sick patients who are in the hospital. One of the big challenges with remdesivir is there's a big shortage of it. There's also plasma therapy. This is experimental, but it's been approved in the US for like emergency authorization where patients get infused with blood from recovered patients. There's preliminary studies that found it helped reduce mortality, but you know, the World Health Organization's chief scientist says the data is inconclusive, of low quality. There's also drugs that have been dropped because of lack of evidence that it could help patients and could even cause heart problems. And that one is hydroxychloroquine.
Right. And we know Donald Trump said he was taking that at one point as a preventive measure.
Yeah. And I mean, even going a step further, when thinking about treatments during a pandemic, there's a common pattern throughout history of the rise of like so-called snake oil salesmen to promote unproven cures and treatments. Again, there's no proven treatment for coronavirus, for COVID-19. So it's a fine balance. And, you know, one example in Peru is that some people have been turning to taking an injectable antiparasitic drug that at a level that's meant for animals. And that's causing a lot of problems.
Wow. It sounds like the studies are still ongoing and still lots to learn.
There is, but I feel like I'm burying something, Marco. And that's when it comes to how doctors are learning from each other in treating recovery and like the supportive care that's going on. Mortality rates have gone down a lot since the early days of the pandemic. The CDC now has it, you know, at least below 10% in the U.S. That's for a lot of reasons. But again, you know, what we've seen is that with these like early preprints that come out for studies and through like Zoom chats and WhatsApp, doctors are learning a lot from each other about these best practices.
Where exactly have you seen this kind of information sharing?
One example is from Northern Italy. It got hit so hard, as you remember, early on with COVID-19. And the doctors there, they started to realize that maybe it's not such a good idea to put people on ventilators so fast. And they started doing more oxygen treatment, figuring out what levels to give. They were sharing this with people around the globe. They also looked at other practices like proning, which is when you put people on your stomachs to help with breathing. Yeah, and so COVID can really damage the lungs, but ventilators can also bring a lot of complications like in the heart and the lungs and the throat. So that those lessons from ventilators from Italy, that's been adopted elsewhere.
Well, as we clearly saw this week, the story continues to evolve and we'll continue to check back in with you for all the updates. Ilana Gordon there on the Global Health Beat for the World. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
As we heard a moment ago, President Trump is hardly the first world leader to contract the coronavirus. Let's return to the case of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Not long after being released from the hospital, he said this.
Good afternoon. I've today left hospital after a week in which the NHS has saved my life. No question.
The NHS, the National Health Service, the way he's managed his country's response to the disease, even after contracting it, remains controversial. Anne McElvoy is host of the Economist Asks podcast from our friends at Economist Radio in London. How things change, Anne. We were set to speak with you about this week's episode of The Economist Asks and the conversation you had with Philip Raines, Hillary Clinton's longtime advisor. That first presidential debate was only a few days ago. It feels like a year ago. But today, the world wakes to the news that President Trump has tested positive for COVID-19. When did you hear the news there in London? And generally, what's been the reaction?
I think everyone was still digesting that debate and opinions were divided, this side of the Atlantic, as they would be in America, about whether it was all within the rough and tumble that you'd expect from Donald Trump or whether it went a few degrees beyond that, and that sense that the whole idea of the debates had been undermined. So that was the argument that we were all having here. And then we woke up, of course, at London time, to find that this news had broken. I'm afraid I saw it originally via the news that Hope Hicks, the spokeswoman, had the virus. And then we suddenly all thought, hang on a minute, oh my goodness, the president has tested positive. And I think that's reframed the entire debate about his response to COVID and also what he said in the debate about COVID.
I'm curious to know what the reaction was when Boris Johnson, the British Prime Minister, landed in intensive care. Take us back, if you would, to those uncertain days in April when the press and the public first heard about Boris Johnson's infection.
Well, I've covered British politics for 20 years and all the prime ministers in that time. And this was like one of the oddest experiences, in that the news kind of leaked out. Boris Johnson himself had tried, I think, foolishly, but you can understand his logic, to soldier on. That's a very Boris Johnson Churchillian style. He thought that somehow he could still do his job. And gradually it became clear to those around him that he was not able to focus and that that Boris Johnson pizzazz that he undoubtedly possesses had gone. He had no energy. By the time he went to hospital, he was very seriously ill. And as we heard in your clip, he did say that he owed his life to the health service, the National Health Service. And it's true. And that reframed the debate, both about Boris Johnson's judgment and had he shown ill judgment, and did you excuse that in the circumstances or didn't you? And what that also meant about his seriousness in dealing with the virus, which had been contended. And I think it really shook him up. I think it changed quite a lot.
Okay, so it reframed the debate in the UK. It shook up the Prime Minister. But after that hospital scare, Have Boris Johnson's views evolved about the coronavirus? And did anything change significantly in the way he's handled it?
Yes, I think a lot changed significantly in the way that Boris Johnson handled COVID and the crisis in the country. For a start, he puts himself much more readily on the side of those saying you should lock down parts of the country where there is a high spike in the COVID rate. That's made him very unpopular with a lot of his own backbenchers, many of whom are saying the economy is suffering more. It's that old dividing line, and that you shouldn't be locking down so hard. And it also means we've got very piecemeal legislation and views about what to do depending where you live. And that is putting a lot of pressure on him. So far, he's trying to hold the line for caution, but it doesn't sit terribly well with his overall leadership style.
So after Boris Johnson's experience with coronavirus, has he reflected at all on the cavalier approach Trump has taken to COVID, someone he once seemed to bond with?
I think he is too cautious of his relationship with Donald Trump to start preaching to the president. I think he thinks other people can do that. I don't think he has the same views as Donald Trump on the coronavirus as on much else. I think that's too readily conflated sometimes in some of the coverage that at least that I see in America. But I think he sent a message very quickly of sympathy to Donald and Melania Trump. I think that what he wants to do is keep that relationship on track in the hope that he can still keep grinding away for the big UK-US trade deal, which is his strategic goal. And he's prepared to go along with a bit of Trumpery along the way. That gets him some brickbats in the UK, of course, from people who abhor Donald Trump and think that that's a mistake. But that's what he's doing.
Anne McElvoy, host of the podcast The Economist Asks, thanks for tacking with us today. Really appreciate you joining us.
Always a pleasure after a busy week.
Okay, let's exhale for a moment and talk jetpacks. Andy Mawson is a paramedic. He works in the Lake District, a rugged part of England where hikers and nature lovers can be climbing in some pretty tough-to-reach spots. If somebody gets hurt, it's going to be Andy to the rescue.
Very often if we're sending the aircraft, the helicopter, and our critical care team to an incident, they might have to land some distance from a patient.
Mawson is the director of operations at Great North Air Ambulance Service. He's got a plane, a helicopter, and soon a jetpack, or jet suit, as they're called in the UK. Yep, straight out of old sci-fi, a fully operational flying suit with multiple jets for a paramedic to wear, cruising them a few feet above the ground like a real-life Iron Man.
Basically, you have a jet turbine engine on your back and jet turbines on your arms, and essentially you just move your arms around to vector that thrust to produce either lift or descent and then flight in any direction that you want.
Just what remote EMS ops require. The suit is made by the English firm Gravity Industries. It's fast. In a test flight, one pilot made it to the top of a steep mountainside in 90 seconds flat.
If someone was to have a cardiac arrest on the top of that mountain, I'm confident that we would have a defibrillator on that patient within 8 minutes.
Wow, like I said, to the rescue. Lawson says for him, the jet suit feels like the latest innovation for his work.
I guess when I set out on the road to be a paramedic, I never dreamed I'd even work on a helicopter. So yeah, it's been an incredible 20 years as a paramedic, and maybe this is, you know, the next step in how we deliver medical care in the mountains. Who knows?
Andy Mawson of the Great North Air Ambulance Service in Northern England, speaking with our colleagues at the CBC program, As It Happens. The U.S. election is just over a month away. Here at The World, we bring you the voices, explore the policies and politics to help put U.S. elections in a global context. Explore more of our election coverage from the international point of view. Just head over to theworld.org/2020election. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Tomorrow, Germany marks an important anniversary. 30 years ago, the reunification of communist East Germany and West Germany. The year before that, the Berlin Wall came down. It took a lot of us in the West by surprise, but the GDR, the former East Germany, was coming under pressure to reform. People were resisting communist rule. There were anti-government demonstrations. East Germans were finding ways to get out.
Hungary opened the border. The people went to Hungary to cross the border to Austria, and thousands of people every day crossed the border.
Peter Brinkman was reporting for a West German newspaper at the time. He recalls that officials in East Germany decided to loosen travel restrictions. But a single word, it turns out, played a very big part in what happened next. The word was immediately. From Berlin, reporter Kevin Kainers has a story.
The West Berlin government got word that the GDR was planning to loosen its travel laws. It just didn't know when. Then one day, Peter Brinkmann got a tip from a friend in the West Berlin government. The journalist should definitely come to East Berlin for an upcoming press conference.
He phoned me and he said, "Peter, come to Berlin. Something is going on. I have no idea what happens, but I think something important will happen. So come to Berlin, just be here."
But Brinkmann's editor in Hamburg was reluctant to let him go.
"Why are you going to Berlin? Nothing will happen. Ask him." "So I don't know what happens. I don't know, but something will happen." And I went back 5-6 times to the editor-in-chief, and then he was upset and said, go, out."
Meanwhile, neighboring Czechoslovakia was getting flooded with East German refugees. Czech officials were threatening to close their border immediately. East Germany had to act. A team of party members quickly drafted new travel regulations, and by that afternoon, the draft had reached the GDR's Communist Party leader, Egon Krenz. At about 4 p.m., he spoke to the party's central committee.
"Said, comrades, very difficult situation. What we will do is wrong. Whatever we do is wrong. But we have to do something. So let us come to the conclusion, everyone who has now a passport can go. Everyone who has no passport can go to the police tomorrow, and then he can ask immediately for a passport." That was the word, immediately.
All of this was drafted into a press release and handed off to the newly minted public relations minister, Günter Schabowski. Only problem was, he hadn't been part of the discussions. As he headed into the press conference, he had no idea what the paper he was holding said. Peter Brinkmann was sitting in the front row.
This room was crowded of journalists. I think some people said 200, 300, 400, I don't know, but it was crowded.
By all accounts, the first 50 minutes of the press conference were incredibly dull. But finally, near the end, an Italian journalist asked Schabowski about proposed changes to the travel regulations. Schabowski talked in vague terms about the need for gradual change. Then suddenly, he remembered the paper he had been handed.
Allerdings ist heute, so viel ich weiß, eine Entscheidung getroffen worden.
And then he was looking the first time in his paper and pulled it out. Said, yeah. And he was reading from the paper, and no one understood what he was reading.
Also, Privatreisen nach dem Ausland können ohne Vorliegen von Voraussetzungen, Reiseanlässe und Verwandtschaften.
Even Schabowski didn't fully understand what he was reading. But going off the paper, he announced that all East Germans would be able to leave the GDR without restrictions. The room was stunned.
And then all of us were starting, when? And then he was reading a few minutes, 2 minutes maybe, and then they said,
"Das tritt nach meiner Kenntnis ist das sofort, unverzüglich."
Unverzüglich, immediately.
Immediately meant that East Germans could get a passport the next day. It did not mean they could leave East Germany that night.
It was written in the paper, but Schabowski didn't see it.
It was a small blunder, but once it was said,
too late. Too late. That's it. Very short, very easy.
The press conference was carried live on East German TV. And afterward, not much seemed to happen. At first, random people headed to the border crossings in Berlin to see if they could cross. But the East German guards were completely confused. They'd received no special instructions and didn't let people through. Then, as more and more people gathered, the scenes became more chaotic. Finally, to relieve the tension, the guards at one crossing started letting a few select people through.
And then the West German television, they saw that the doors at the Bornholmer Street in the Invalidenstraße opened.
Hier ist das erste deutsche Fernsehen mit den Tagesthemen.
That night, Western television newscasts started announcing that the borders were open for East Germans to cross.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren. Dieser 9. November ist ein historischer Tag. Die DDR hat mitgeteilt, dass ihre Grenzen...
After 10, after the television shows the open gate, Bonhomme Street. Now the GDR citizens woke up. They telephoned each other and said, did you hear Schabowski? Yes, but what did he say? I don't know. But now on television, we see that the wall is open. Let's come. Let's go. Maybe tomorrow it's closed again.
What had started as a trickle became a flood.
And so between 10 and midnight, thousands of people rushed to the border. Everyone was crying, everyone was screaming, everyone was shouting the same words, Wahnsinn! Wahnsinn!
Wahnsinn!
Madness. Madness, they said.
And then it's over. Totally over. That was the feeling everyone had in the night. If you were at the Brandenburg Gate or somewhere else, you see this was over.
With the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the GDR was inevitable.
No, the people saw the West and said, why do we need the wall anymore? And only a few weeks later, they started to demolish it. And without the wall, why do we need the GDR?
In March, just 3 months later, free elections were held. In June, the East adapted the West German currency. And on October 3rd, East Germany ceased to exist. 30 years later, you can still sense some lingering differences between the Eastern and Western territories of unified Germany, but they continue to fade with time. And who knows how many people in today's Germany know or remember that a hastily read document and one misspoken word brought down a wall and helped ensure that two Germanys would once again become one. For the World, I'm Kevin Kainers in Berlin.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour. You're with The World. The world's great marathons have been canceled. London is going ahead with theirs this weekend.
We are confined to a 40-acre undisclosed location.
A handful of elite runners joined virtually by 45,000 amateurs. Also ahead, more global reaction to the president testing positive here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from GBH Boston and PRX. As if things couldn't get any stranger this election season, this week concludes with a massive wow. But if you look beyond the president's diagnosis and a wild debate on Tuesday, the vision of the next president, whoever that is, there are still multiple policy issues to keep track of. U.S. foreign policy, climate change, and more. Here at The World, we're keeping our eyes on these important topics through Election Day.
The whole world is watching.
The most important election.
Human rights.
Climate change.
Race. Immigration.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
Each Friday, we're chatting with our reporters across the globe about what they're seeing as the campaigns in the U.S. move ahead. Shirin Jafari keeps an eye on the Mideast for us.
Hello, Marco.
Hey there. And Jorge Valencia covers Latin America for the show.
Hey, Marco.
Welcome to you both. So briefly, this news of Trump's COVID test, how is this hitting in your region? Jorge, what's the view across Latin America?
Well, this is big news, and it's something that some countries in Latin America have already seen. The presidents of, Guatemala, Honduras, Bolivia, and Brazil. These presidents have all been diagnosed with the coronavirus and have survived the coronavirus. In Brazil's case, there are some similarities with the U.S. because Brazil is one of the top countries leading in the number of cases and in the number of deaths. And President Jair Bolsonaro has drawn many comparisons to President Trump because many experts believe that he's taken a somewhat cavalier and dismissive perspective towards the coronavirus.
Shirin, what kind of reactions are you seeing today in the Mideast?
Well, Marco, you know, one of the countries that was hit really hard early on was Iran. You might remember that. After China, Iran had one of the biggest and highest rates of COVID-19. And I remember reading about several officials who got infected, members of the parliament, even the health minister himself and the vice president came down with the coronavirus. So people are reading about it and paying attention to it.
So as for the campaign issues as they play out abroad, Jorge, looking at one big headline on your beat, a few thousand people left Honduras this week on foot headed toward the U.S. in what's become known as a migrant caravan. What do we know about this one, and will it be a factor in the election?
Oh, this already is a factor. This has been a factor. When we began seeing groups of people, hundreds, maybe even thousands of people traveling from Central America together on television in 2018, the president started making that part of his rhetoric. And so through agreements with the governments in Mexico, some governments in Central America, the Trump administration has actually succeeded in many ways making it near impossible for people to petition for asylum on the southwest border. And despite that, we still have groups like this one. And this group in some ways, it looks very similar to caravans that we have seen in the last 2 years.
And who are the people traveling in this group, and what are their reasons for leaving?
Yeah, the reasons appear to be unchanged. Extreme poverty, running from organized crime, running from government violence. This caravan originated in San Pedro Sula, the second largest city in Honduras. And a local newscast, HCH, a reporter spoke to people as they were leaving the city. First, you're going to hear from the reporter, and then you'll hear from a man who he's interviewing. This man is walking out, he's dragging a suitcase, and he's carrying a child on his shoulders. So this man, he says his name is Wilmer. He says he's leaving with his entire family. They are six of them. And he says that they're desperate. They know of how difficult it is to get into the United States, but they'll do anything just to get anywhere else because they have no opportunities where they are.
Right. So that flight from Central America continues. Shirin Jafari, let me turn to you. What are you looking for in the Mideast as we get closer to the election?
One thing I'll be looking out for is what each candidate says about Iran. Tensions between the U.S. and the Islamic Republic have been really high in the past few months. There are almost daily reports of attacks on U.S. bases and interests in Iraq. And Iran has a lot of influence in Iraq. Back in January, the U.S. killed a key Iranian general, Qasem Soleimani. So there's a lot of mistrust and tension between these two countries.
What have you heard so far on how Trump and Biden are speaking about Iran?
Well, you might remember that President Trump absolutely hated the Iran nuclear deal. One of his arguments was that the U.S. gave a lot of concessions to Iran and that he could make a better deal. So in May 2018,
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Right. The U.S. walked out.
Yeah, and instead it launched something called the Maximum Pressure Campaign. The idea here is that the U.S. squeezes Iran so much that it comes back to the negotiating table and renegotiates a better deal. So far, that hasn't happened. And Marco, often these policies, they just end up hurting everyday people more than the government. I've been speaking with a few people inside Iran about how they're following the elections in the U.S. This is Amir. He's a graphic designer in Tehran. And he told me he's glued to social media and news sites to read about the elections in the U.S. because to him, whoever ends up in the White House will have a huge impact on his day-to-day life. Something that has affected him personally is U.S. sanctions because that means he can't access financial systems and the banking systems. So whenever he does something for international companies, he can't pay them. He can't get paid. So it's really hurting him financially. President Trump is confident that Iran will come back to sign a better deal with the U.S. And Joe Biden says if he's elected, he's going to go back to the 2015 deal. He's more in favor of a more diplomatic approach with Iran.
Interestingly, Jorge Valencia, you've been reporting on another country where the Trump administration has been implementing what they call a maximum pressure campaign. That'd be Venezuela.
Yeah, I would say that at least in Latin America, Venezuela is the highest foreign policy priority for the Trump administration. Many political scientists, political observers believe that this has something to do with constituents in the important battleground state of Florida. It's a state where there is a large Venezuelan diaspora. So I spoke about this with Frank Mora. He's a political scientist at Florida International University in Miami.
And so his strategy has been to, in my opinion, sort of cynically manipulate the emotions, the passions, the frustrations that Venezuelans have here in South Florida with what's going on in their country, their home country, which is truly tragic.
Jorge, do we know how Joe Biden sees a crisis in Venezuela? Is he quietly on the side of Trump? Does he want to see President Nicolas Maduro out?
I think quietly might be a good way of putting it, just because Biden's campaign has not given any indication that their policies would necessarily be dramatically different from the Trump administration's. They just haven't been as vocal about it.
Let me land back in the Middle East. Shirin, something that President Trump has talked a lot about recently is Israel. Where do things stand today?
Yeah, and Marco, since the beginning of his presidency, Trump has said he wants to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And just in the past few weeks, we saw the announcement about the Israeli agreement with two other Arab countries, the UAE and Bahrain. Trump calls this a major breakthrough. As for Joe Biden, he also supports these deals with Israel. But at the same time, he wants Israel to work with the Palestinians and come up with a two-state solution. This is, of course, a more complicated approach than what the Trump administration has been taking.
The world's Shirin Jafari and Jorge Valencia will be turning to you in the days ahead as you follow the impact overseas of what is now a very curious presidential race here in the U.S. Thank you both for this update.
Welcome, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
Polls suggest President Trump has much less support among people of color and immigrants than former Vice President Biden. But this weekend, some Filipino-American communities are planning caravans to show their support for President Trump. Gatherings are happening in Oregon, South Carolina, Virginia, Nevada, and California. The World's Rupa Shenoy spoke with some of the organizers in the Los Angeles area.
The main event is on Sunday, but festivities will start Saturday night.
You know, Filipinos, we're social people, so we love to gather.
Mark Ang is the son of ethnically Chinese immigrants from the Philippines and one of the event organizers. Filipinos are one of the largest ethnic groups in California, and people will gather in four different parts of Los Angeles to decorate cars that'll be in the caravan.
And then the next day when we actually have the rally, we'll have some judges that will decide which region had the most spirit.
There might even be small prizes at that rally before the caravan, he says.
You know, we're going to have people sing like Star Spangled Banner and Filipino anthem, stuff like that. We will have some light food. We call it merienda, like light snacks.
Ang says there will be speakers like business leaders and Filipino-American politicians. They'll talk about what Ang says are big issues for conservative Filipinos, like the fear of encroaching communism in the U.S., frustration over regulations that business owners say are stifling, and anger over property damage that happened during the Black Lives Matter protests. There's also Prop 16, a California ballot measure that would allow race as a factor in public sector hiring and college admissions in order to improve diversity. Ang says that could mean fewer Asians in public universities.
So that is straight up discrimination, straight up racism. They were all united under this one issue of Prop 16 threatening Asian students from entering the UCs and Cal States at the rates that they currently are used to.
After the rally, participants will get in their cars and drive a small parade route to different Filipino areas. Ang says 500 people have RSVP'd.
Prop 16 equals racism.
He says it'll sound a lot like this caravan he put together for a conservative Chinese community in August.
Do not judge me by skin color.
About a third of Filipino Americans plan to vote for Trump, according to a recent survey. Catherine Nassal is at the University of California Davis's Bulacan Center for Filipino Studies.
What folks should know, especially when we see Filipinos for Trump, is that there's also like a growing base of folks in our community who are pushing back against those values.
For some, that's because of Trump's response to COVID-19. The pandemic has hit Filipino Americans hard because so many are nurses and essential workers. And Nassal says there's tension between age groups. Many young Filipinos have faced anti-immigrant rhetoric and want to stand with Black Lives Matter protesters. There's also a growing movement to stop the Trump administration from selling arms to Filipino President Rodrigo Duterte, who's accused of many human rights violations.
For a lot of Filipino families, like, they're not only just looking at Trump, but they're also looking at how is this election in the U.S. going to impact my family members in the Philippines.
But for one relatively recent immigrant helping organize the caravan in L.A. this weekend, the Filipino tradition of Catholicism is most important.
For me, it's all about abortion, period.
Jessa De Guzman is a psychologist who sits on the board of the National Filipino American Association. Her older brother has been a priest for 20 years. De Guzman came to the U.S. a decade ago and became a citizen 2 years ago. She's excited to cast her first presidential ballot for Trump.
He's the only president I knew who is really against abortion. I got some friends who got because of me, and you know, but I don't care. It's a given, right? Yeah, as long as you stand on what you believe in, who cares? That's just it.
Along with other conservative Filipino Americans, De Guzman will be proclaiming her beliefs proudly this weekend by driving through L.A. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
Big oil is getting smaller. Europe's largest oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, is announcing some big job cuts, up to 9,000 people in the next few years. These cuts follow a global collapse in demand for oil this year due to pandemic shutdowns. Kathy Hipple is a financial analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. So Shell is not the first to cut back its workforce. In June, European oil giant BP announced they're cutting 10,000 jobs. Kathy, to what extent are these cuts due to coronavirus lockdowns?
To a certain extent, they are due to the coronavirus lockdowns. But to a larger extent, it's important to see them in a 10-year context. The industry is a mature industry, and it's been in decline for at least a decade. So the coronavirus lockdown certainly did not help demand forecasts, but this industry has been in distress in many respects for a full decade.
As cars get back on the road, though, and economies open back up, do you think the industry will rebound, or has the pandemic kind of signaled a major pivot to some other new energy paradigm?
We believe the energy transition is well underway and has been underway for some time. Some of the oil companies, such as BP, already said maybe we've already hit peak oil demand and we may never see it go back to what it was in 2018 and 2019. So, yes, it's very difficult to forecast what will happen when people begin flying again. That's been the hardest hit, obviously, and when they begin driving again. But it's also important to remember how quickly the costs have come down for renewables. And that is very important because the new marginal generation is being created by renewables, and they have a much lower cost structure than coal, oil, and gas. So they will ultimately displace in the electric grid. They've already displaced coal, but it will ultimately, we believe, also displace gas.
Well, we do see with both Shell and BP expansions of their renewable energy portfolios. Shell has set a target of net zero emissions by 2050. But do you think it's possible for these companies to become leaders in renewable energy? I mean, what are the challenges for these kind of traditional oil companies?
So the question is, can they pivot? And the reality is, rarely do legacy companies pivot. Generally, for private companies, they tend to look backward. And as we know, finance is all about looking forward. Mm. I think one of the reasons that companies also rarely pivot is that most of the people in these oil and gas companies have never worked outside the industry, and most have never even worked in a different company. So all they know is that one company, that one industry, and they almost have a failure of imagination.
So does this also mean that big oil is starting to abandon its quest for so-called tough oil, you know, oil in very hard-to-access locations like thousands of feet below the floor of the Gulf of Mexico or fracking operations?
You're absolutely right. It's not that fracking is so difficult to reach that oil. However, the financials of fracking have been poor for a decade. So fracking, interestingly, produced a huge production boom, but it was a financial bust. Will they abandon fracking? Probably not. But might they abandon some of the even harder to reach, as you say, ocean floor in the Arctic, some of those what we call extreme projects? Yes.
Another sign of the decline in the oil industry for the last decade, U.S.-based ExxonMobil is worth a third today of what it was worth in 2008. Dozens of oil and gas producers have also filed for bankruptcy this year. Kathy, you see the start of a new chapter here that leaves the era of big oil in the past for good?
Well, back in the 1980s, the oil and gas sector comprised 28% of the S&P 500. And now, at the end of June, it was down to 2.3% of the S&P 500.
Wow.
So we've got the world economy growing since 1980, but the oil and gas sector shrinking on a relative basis compared to the rest of the economy. And you can just see the old energy, the fossil energy, is declining.
Kathy Hipple is an analyst with the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis. She's been speaking with us from Bennington, Vermont. Thank you very much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Hours before President Trump announced he had the coronavirus, he went on Fox News.
I condemn the KKK. I condemn all white supremacists. I condemn the Proud Boys.
A lot of us are now thinking about the Proud Boys. As the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, a British clothing brand has been thinking about them for a while.
The British brand Fred Perry announced last week they would stop selling their black and yellow polo shirts in the U.S. and Canada because they had become the shirts of choice for the Proud Boys. The company won't respond to interview requests, though they posted a statement on their website saying Fred Perry is frustrated to see their shirt co-opted and subverted. The writer Zoe Beery told me how the Proud Boys started wearing this polo to begin with.
So the Proud Boys were founded by Gavin McInnes.
Hey, what's up? My name's Gavin.
And Gavin McInnes is also kind of a sartorialist himself. And he started wearing the black and yellow Fred Perry polos on air for his radio show.
Fred Perry shirts are neat and tidy. And when you have terrible wimp Grover shoulders like mine.
He picked black and yellow because of the Wiz Khalifa song. There is no deeper meaning there.
But the connection between the Fred Perry fashion label and white supremacy goes back decades. The company's polo shirt started in the 1950s as a tennis shirt that the upper classes would wear to the country club. Then in the 60s, mod fashion became a thing. So brightly colored, flashy, close-fitting suits, think like Elton John. White working-class youth wouldn't be caught dead in that stuff. And at the same time, Zoe Beery says they needed a look of their own.
They looked back into the archives of British fashion and found Fred Perry. Fred Perry, the person, was one of them. He was a working-class person who had achieved great success. But because the brand was worn by posh British people, the reclamation of it was kind of like a dig at the classism that the brand had come to represent.
Then in the 1970s, those same white working class youth were recruited by the far-right extremist group in the UK called the National Front. And those Fred Perry polo shirts came with them. But what's new about the Proud Boys is they only wear the black and yellow shirt. Beery says it wouldn't have taken much for the company to have stopped making that shirt years ago. In fact, the CEO is on record as early as 2017 saying he knew about the connection to the Proud Boys.
It's very interesting to me that they knew a very specific product of theirs that they could have pulled from shelves was generating profit for them based on white supremacy, and they chose not to discontinue it for 2 years.
Beery says she'd like to see any profits from the sale of the shirt donated to anti-racism NGOs. In any case, it's clear the company has to do something. The shirt is still available for sale outside of North America, and the Proud Boys in the UK are vowing to buy them up and ship them to their brethren over here. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Marathons during a pandemic, it is a big risk. Lots of people running side by side for hours. That's why tens of thousands of runners around the world are really looking forward to this weekend. Here's The World's Bianca Hillier.
Nobody was surprised during the final stretch of the 2019 London Marathon.
We've got a queen in London, but here's the king. Eliud Kipchoge is the champion again.
Eliud Kipchoge, the star distance runner from Kenya, seemed to effortlessly glide to first place, breaking the tape in front of thousands of fans. Kipchoge will toe the line again on Sunday for the 40th running of the London Marathon.
But as for that roaring crowd, this year, he'll have to use his imagination. No fans will be allowed on the course. No amateur runners dressed as the Queen or Big Ben. Just a small pool of elite athletes.
This gentleman here is going to tell you your COVID testing.
Athletes arrived in England on Monday and have been living in a bubble ever since. American runner Molly Seidel told Sidious magazine about life inside.
We are confined to a 40-acre undisclosed location. It's very fancy. The food is great. It's wild.
And it gets more wild. Seidel says that within the bubble, social distancing is being enforced with a little help from wearable tech.
We have to wear these beepers. So if you go within 6 feet of anyone, it starts alarming.
The beepers are about the size of a post-it note and are attached to a necklace that everyone has to wear outside their hotel room. The system doesn't track people's movements. It just makes this sound when one beeper is too close to another beeper. Athletes won't wear the devices or masks during Sunday's race. Instead of taking the iconic course across the Tower Bridge and past the London Eye, they'll run 20 identical laps around St. James's Park. In a press conference this week, reigning champ Eliud Kipchoge said he's ready to race.
I'm feeling well. I'm happy to be back here in London. Personally, I'm happy to come back and run again after a very long time.
It's exciting to watch top athletes compete in person again. But what's really cool about the race on Sunday is that 45,000 runners in 60 countries will also technically be running the London Marathon, including Yogendra Pratap Singh.
I am excited and nervous at the same time.
Singh will be running the London Marathon in Assam, India. It's his first marathon, and he hopes that running along a tried-and-true route will provide a type of home field advantage, which is what first-timer Melanie Spencer is banking on, too. She's been training in Linlithgow, Scotland, since February.
I actually just want it done now because I've been training for so many months.
Spencer says she's finding it a bit hard to get excited about the race without the fanfare that a major marathon brings.
I mean, it's a great achievement, but you run London to run London. I could run 26 miles here any time I like.
The incentive to keep going, she says, is raising money for charity. The London Marathon is known for its philanthropy. 2019's race brought in $86 million. And Oren Finnegan, a runner from Switzerland, says being able to keep fundraising during a pandemic is the best part of this virtual race.
I think that would have been a terrible loss. So it's good that something's being run that at least will negate that to some extent.
The 10-time marathoner is racing solo on Sunday, but says that as he runs around a lake in Geneva, he'll know he's not alone.
Being out there and knowing that there are going to be a lot of other people running it on the same day all over the world, it's sort of a connection in its own way.
That connection will be on Eliud Kipchoge's mind, too. He said he appreciates the thousands running around the world.
Please feel it, enjoy. We'll finish together. In spirits, we are together. And together, we can rise up against this COVID-19.
To watch Kipchoge and the other top runners, make sure to set an alarm. The women's race will begin at 7:15 a.m. in London, and the men will hit the course at 10:15. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Getting us across the finish line at the end of a long week. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio, I'm Marco Werman. You all stay safe, be healthy, and have a great weekend.